We come together in worship with these words from Dr. King. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves in the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. If we make the right choices, we'll be able to speed up the day all over America and over the world, when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Okay. So before we begin Joys and Concerns, I'd like to recognize those from our church who are going to participate in the Women's March on Washington or its sister march here in Boston next Saturday, January 21st. We had quite a group of people at the 9 o'clock service, and those who are at this service who are going to do that, I'd ask you if you would be willing to stand now. Great. And if you can remain, can you remain standing for just a minute? Thanks. After an election season that degraded and demonized women and victims of sexual assault, Muslims, GBLTQ folks, black and brown people, Native Americans, people with disabilities, immigrants and other minorities or disempowered groups. The Women's March on Washington is an exercise of democracy to demonstrate through the presence of great numbers of people that they will not allow the rights of women and all of those marginalized groups to be ignored. It is a bold statement sent on the first day of the new administration that women's rights are human rights. To those of you going, know that your actions are a way of putting this faith into action, a way of affirming the principles that are our foundation, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relationships, respect for the interconnected web of all existence, and the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. On behalf of the congregation, I charge you to represent this faith well, to stand and march in solidarity with sisters and brothers different from you, building bridges between communities by sharing that sacred time with them. With peaceful means, demonstrate to this nation that we are a nation where rights will not be denied. Be prepared for the cold weather, be careful with the crowds, and be respectful of each other and of those who are there to assure your safety. Be proud of this faith and the values you will represent. Go and march well. We have words of prayer written for Martin Luther King Jr. Sunday by my colleague Kathleen Rollins. Spirit of Justice, God who befriends those who stand upon the constant edge of decision, crucial and alone, we're grateful to be together this morning. We gather especially to remember Dr. King, but not only him, for there were thousands of unnamed women and men who put their bodies and lives on the line so that all may be free. And yet freedom comes at a cost. And we know that racism and homophobia, ageism, ableism, sexism and classism, all of these often unacknowledged realities prevent us from fully knowing one another, from creating the beloved community spoken of by the prophets and ordinary persons alike. May the work of Dr. King continue to eradicate injustice wherever and whenever we encounter it. May we continue to speak out against injustice, to speak even when we're afraid our words will not be heard or welcomed. May the spirit of Dr. King continue to flow through our daily living. May we have the courage of Dr. King as we continue to stand up for justice, reconciliation, and truth despite challenge and controversy. Dr. King went to the mountaintop. He saw the promised land, and he reassured us we will get there one day. May that not be a paradisal dream, but a reality in our own time. May it be so. Amen. Precious Lord, the hymn was Dr. King's favorite hymn. It was a source of personal strength for him in difficult times. And some say it was the strength of the entire civil rights movement, bringing comfort and inspiration to still move forward toward their goal, even in the most difficult of circumstances. Dr. King would ask Mahalia Jackson to sing it at civil rights rallies. And on the last time when Dr. King preached in his home church, Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta, Georgia, he, like so many of the prophets before him, spoke of the difficult time in his struggle. He was very tired and troubled and told the congregation he knew he would not be here to see the dream fulfilled. His mother was at the organ, and this is the hymn they all together sang. Among his very last words, just before he was shot, was a request to have that hymn sung at the service he was going to attend that night. And he had always said he wanted it sung at his funeral, and indeed, Mahalia Jackson did. We all have times in our lives when we are weary and tired and need a spiritual hand. However we may perceive that, a hand that will take our hand and lead us on through the dark to the light. Please join in singing hymn number 199, Precious Lord. You may remain seated, and then in silence, I invite you to feel that presence here among us.
Lead me on, let me stand.
inspired by the march that's planned for this week in Washington, my thoughts went back to the 1963 march where Dr. King made that speech that's come to be known as I Have a Dream. I'd like to read to you a good portion of that speech this morning. 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of captivity. But 100 years later, we must face the tragic fact that the Negro is still not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languishing in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. So we have come here today to dramatize an appalling condition. In a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men would be guaranteed the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we have come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or taking the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to open the doors of opportunity to all of God's children. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you come fresh from narrow cells. Some of you come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and the staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi, to Alabama, to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow the situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, that in spite of the difficulties and frustrations of the moment, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at a table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a desert state sweltering with the heat of injustice and oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day the state of Alabama, whose governor's lips are presently dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, will be transformed into a situation where little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls and walk together as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith with which I return to the South. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will all be free one day. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the hills of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous peaks of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and every molehill of Mississippi, every mountainside. Let freedom ring. When we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." I invite you now to sing one of the great hymns of the struggle, "Lift Every Voice," number 149. It was a century after the Emancipation Proclamation that Dr. King delivered those powerful and hopeful words in front of the Lincoln Memorial on the National Mall. Today, another half century later, things have certainly changed. Today, if you are there where he was, you'll find another monument built nearby. In fact, within sight of the Lincoln Memorial, it's a monument to Dr. King, that black man who spoke those words 50 years earlier. And not far from those monuments is the White House, where today you would see a black family living and a black president finishing his second term in office. And just within the past few months, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, part of our National Capitol's complex of museums known as the Smithsonian Institute, opened to celebrate the lives and accomplishments of great black Americans. Of course, this is the result of 50 years of progress, of civil rights legislation passed and enforced, and an increased understanding and legal acceptance of racial equality in all spheres of life. So on the surface, you might be inclined to think, we can surely celebrate that the dream has come true. Certainly in the legislation passed, in the pristine beauty of our nation's capital, especially its monuments and architecture, you would think so. But let's move out to show beyond what's beyond those places of national monuments. Let's move away from the surface and go deeper. And when we do, I am afraid that what we'll find there will give us more cause for concern than celebration. This week in Charleston, South Carolina, a man who so strongly rejected everything in Dr. King's dream, whose heart remained full of racism through his entire trial, who never showed one sign of remorse, was sentenced to death for killing 9 black people at a Wednesday night prayer meeting in their church. This week in Washington, D.C., hearings have been underway for a nominee for Attorney General who has a history of racist actions in voting in Congress. This is not a nominee for just any office, but for the very office that those who may be treated unfairly because of race or sexual orientation or gender identification would turn to find aggressive enforcement of civil rights laws. This coming week, also in Washington and many other cities, women and their allies will again be marching in the streets for justice, and central among the causes that their voices will raise is the plight of those of color in our nation. Along with support for women's issues and GBLTQ issues and immigrant issues, there will be many signs that say Black Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter and Native American Lives Matter. Again, voices of anti-racism will be speaking truth to power in Washington the same way they did 50-plus years ago when Dr. King gave that famous speech. Black Lives Matter banners continue to hang on churches throughout this land, and there's a reason for it. It is because we, too, have a dream. It's not a reality yet. It is certainly closer than it was 50 years ago, but we are reminded daily, in ways large and small, that racism still exists at the level of both institutions and individuals in our society. Building monuments and museums to honor black folks, putting a black family in the big white house, have not destroyed all of the deeper and sometimes disguised racism that manifests itself in so many ways in our society. This week in El Cajon, California, a prosecutor declined to bring any charges against police officers who shot and killed a mentally disturbed, unarmed black man. I don't know all the facts of the case, and I'm not here to pass judgment on this particular officer. But we have heard this story too many times before. It is yet another in a long line of either failures to prosecute or acquittals of police officers who killed unarmed black men and boys. The good news is that we are now paying more attention. A few years ago, most of these killings went unnoticed at any kind of significant level of national news. But now the accumulation of these killings of black men and boys cause us to face the fact that there is indeed a problem. You know, each time there is one of these killings, I ask myself, would that officer have responded in the same way if the young man was white? Was his or her fear or perception of the circumstances different because the individual was black? What do you think? Certainly, not every time, but much of the time, my gut tells me that that is the case. Now, I make a disclaimer every time I go near this subject, and I want to do it again this morning, because I am not anti-police. In my prior profession as a DA, I worked with police all the time and know there are many good officers. But I also know that there is racism in the criminal justice system as an institution, and there is racism among some police. And it is demonstrated in how they treat black individuals, especially in the most difficult of situations. The truth is that young black males are at a far greater risk of being shot dead by police than their white counterparts. In fact, 21 times greater risk, according to ProPublica's analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings. And as you'll remember, for those who were here from our engagement in my preaching on Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. For those not killed on the streets, the likelihood of incarceration for black men is astronomical. 3 out of 4 black men will serve time. And this amazes me. The United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. And even though statistics show that whites and blacks use and sell drugs at a very similar rate, blacks go to jail far more often for it. In fact, in some states, 20 to 50 times more often. Folks, you've heard me recall incidents and facts like these before. They are important to point out both the reality and the magnitude of the problem. They have and are leading to changes in the operation of police departments and court systems. There is more training going on, more monitoring going on. But still, there is something much deeper that we must address. You know, for me, the most troubling thing in this last election cycle was the way that hate and anger for certain groups of people surfaced. I'm thrilled that many are going to this Women's Watch on Washington. I counted 40 or 50 people here between the two services. They're going to remind all those officials elected to office in both parties that from the get-go of this administration, there are many watching to be sure that the rights of blacks and Native Americans, of immigrants, of Muslims, of women, of gay, lesbian, transgender folks, of the poor, of the mentally ill, of the abused, of the less fortunate, are protected. Sadly, when a presidential candidate said things like, Mexican immigrants are rapists, and suggested Muslims should be banned from entering this country and those here forced to register, it did something. It struck a chord with those who deep in their hearts harbor racist feelings. They felt legitimized, empowered to speak out. Many of these hateful voices, voices that we now label as the alt or alternative right, are in fact truly voices of white supremacy and superiority. They are voices of those who don't see the beauty in the rainbow of diversity in this country. They see difference as a threat to our nation, not an opportunity. They see our nation as a white country intended to be that way, and it should be controlled by white people. It is this racism that sees the rise of folks of color into positions of authority and the welcoming of non-white, non-Christian immigrants as a destructive and threatening force. Some in this movement go so far as to label the integration of these folks into our society as white genocide. I hope our new president, now that he's been elected, will stop giving those people a wink and a nod and start speaking out in ways that do not target a group of people because of their race, ethnicity, or religion. We need a president that inspires us to bring our best side to the public debate of our time, not our worst, our fears, and our prejudices. All of us, white folks here, all at least of us who are my age and older, have been on a journey of understanding how racism has been a part of our life. I never doubted that people who are brought up in a racist society likely still have racism in some form in their heart. You know, I remember my grandfather using the N-word, and I remember my other grandfather not willing to rent or employ black people. Certainly, many of our parents or grandparents harbor racist views. And most of us, in some way, maybe much less blatant, have also had them. Many of us here have worked at that. We've admitted that. We've addressed that. We've tried to learn from it and move beyond it. This journey is not about denying the facts. If you are a white person, it's in your history. It's about owning it and then working to disown it. You know, I'm not surprised that a 70-year-old white man from Alabama might have started out in his professional life with some racist ideas in his head. In fact, I'd find it hard to believe he did not. What I was hoping to hear in those attorney general hearings was not this insistence that I never was a racist, I never had race in my mind when I made a decision, but instead that I have learned and worked to reject my racist past, and I'm committed to do the same in every way possible from the position of attorney general. Dr. King's dreams will never come true until those who feel that the gain of others is their loss have a change of heart. The dream cannot come true unless we're vigilant and vocal when we see racism, even in the most subtle ways. You know, people are now wrapped up in this idea of making America great. And I would like to see America great, too. And if you listen to those words in Dr. King's speech and think back, that's what Dr. King was talking about, how to make America great. He used those words. Making America great is making America be what it's supposed to be. But making America great can never mean targeting certain people because of race, ethnicity, or religion. We can only make America great when there is real respect and equal opportunity for everyone, regardless of their race, nationality, or creed. Making America great cannot ever mean treating people unfairly or excluding them for no crime or malfeasance, but simply for being who they are. We can only make America great when there's fairness and compassion in our immigration policies and in our criminal justice system, when there's equality in all matters for all races and religions, for women, for gays, for lesbians, for transgender folks, for those differently able. America can only be great when there is caring and compassion for people less fortunate. A great America leads by moral example, cooperation, and common purpose. Sure, we'd all want this kind of a great America, the kind that makes good on the check it has written to all in its founding documents, the kind of which Dr. King dreamed. But you know, this slogan we hear, make America great again, has become sort of a disguised language for returning to a time when white male power was really all there was. That was never great. But as Dr. King pointed out, in those founding documents of our nation, there is a promise of a great nation. And it was there then, even though it did not reflect the reality of that time either. The struggle for equality is far from over. It has proven to be a long journey with lots of obstacles. Dr. King used to like to say that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Those words are carved on his memorial that I talked about, and they've been attributed to him. But do you know where they actually come from? Our own Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, who spoke them in Boston in the mid-1800s. And don't I wish the arc would bend faster? There is still a great deal of work to be done. And we can now see that there are many who live in deep fear that is at least in part fueled by racist ideas. The work to be done is daunting. And the truth is that we are called to do it. We are a faith who proclaimed as our first principle the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We have to live our lives in ways that always have that teaching front and center. We have to call out our officials and our neighbors when their actions go contrary to this principle. We have to unite with others who find a similar message in their faith, a message like every individual is created in the image of God, or that loving your neighbor means not just loving the neighbor that looks like you, but especially the one that does not. We need to welcome diversity into our lives, our families, our churches, our schools. We are facing proposed policies that are racist to the core, and many more policies that try to deny the basic principles of equality and fairness to people. Perhaps we have come complacent on this issue of race inequality, thinking that things are moving in the right direction on their own. Well, folks, they are not. What I hope is that the revelation of these new challenges will fuel the recommitment of those who believe in the real things that will make America great. It is time for us to really push to bend the arc. Folks, the times, as we witness in the news every day, even as we hear in the words of those we've chosen to lead us, are troubled with respect, disrespect for true racial equality. But I don't think the dream is dead. It's a dream of what really would make America great. I think we're entering a new chapter in the struggle, and even knowing all the complexities, even knowing our own personal fears and misunderstandings, even knowing that there are pitfalls at every turn, we have no choice but to still proclaim that the dream will come true. We proclaim that deep in our hearts that we do believe that we shall overcome racism someday. Hymn number 169, We Shall Overcome. inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. Hatred and bitterness can never cure the disease of fear. Only love can do that.